borrowed conviction is worse than borrowed money.
You know, it's easy to get carried away by certain types of personalities, certain types of investors, or certain types of investments. What we want to have is the ability to make decisions on our own. We all have the capacity to make the right decision, but we many times get carried away by the bigger personalities, the interesting investment opportunities, and the decisions that these bigger personalities, have made to invest in a specific security. Unless you know them exceptionally well, and you're essentially blind on the other side. Just because this manager has invested, it doesn't mean that it gives you the required amount of confidence to invest in it.
And the explanation cannot be found in any mathematics, but it has to be found in investor psychology.
You know, the game in our kind of life is being able to recognize a good idea when you rarely get it. What is the old saying? That opportunity comes to the prepared mind.
Human nature hasn't changed a lot in 25,000 years. I think volatility is terrific.
Lose money for the firm and I will be understanding. Lose a shred of reputation for the firm and I will be ruthless.
Welcome to AUM. On this show, we dive into the process, strategy, methods, and lessons from some of the world's best asset managers. We explore what it takes to produce outstanding investment outcomes in the complex, adaptive system that is modern markets. I'm your host, Ryan Henderson, and today I have the pleasure of being joined by Srikanth Viswanathan. Srikanth is the founder and portfolio manager of SVN Capital. He founded SVN in 2018 after more than 14 years of portfolio management and analyst experience at various firms. Srikanth, it is a pleasure to have you on the show. And I guess the first question to kick things off is, what inspired you to start VSN?
Ryan, thanks a lot for having me. It's a pleasure to be invited to a great podcast. So to answer your question, maybe a little bit of background would help. I'm originally from India. I came here as a student pursuing graduate studies in accounting and forgot to buy a ticket back home. And I've stayed here ever since. Went to University of Chicago for my MBA and went on to be an investment banker. M&A banker. And then I had an opportunity to come to Chicago to be a founding partner of a small hedge fund. One thing led to another. I ended up at Advisory Research, a storied franchise in Chicago. And I spent almost 10 years, a little less, at Advisory and then moved on to Keeley Asset Management, which is another storied franchise before launching SVN Capital. Today, SVN Capital is a concentrated, global, long-only equity fund. And various different aspects of my experience have essentially been combined into this baby that I've created. So I spent a lot of time, as you mentioned in the intro, in the industry. And Ryan, when you spend a lot of time in one company or one industry, you tend to see some of the skeletons in the closet. So as I went along, I did notice quite a few skeletons, and I made a note to myself as I went along, didn't do much. But in August of 2010, I remember the exact date, I made this decision. In August of 2010, I decided to start my own fund. I wasn't physically, financially, emotionally ready at that point, but that's the point at which I decided that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. I was working at Advisory. Advisory Research is a storied franchise here in Chicago, a number of different strategies. I was involved in a few of them. It was acquired by Piper Jaffray, a Minneapolis-based, at that time, Minneapolis-based investment bank. And post that acquisition is when I made this decision. There were features that I liked, features that were that raised questions, and I love, you know, what I was doing at Advisory. I learned a lot, and I just love this aspect of constantly being educated and challenged by the market. This is one of the few professions that allows you to subject yourself to that kind of a challenge and be at the same time educated all through the day. So that was the moment I launched it. Why did I launch it? I mean, there are certain questions like that that are sort of unanswerable when you ask a mountain climber, you know, why do you climb this mountain? You know, I've read a few books on that, and one of them said, because it's there. You know, that's kind of a tongue-in-cheek kind of an answer, but something in them motivates them to do that. This is, I think, a sort of an outcome of my own family background. My grandfather had founded a company back in India. Maybe it's a residue from that gene that sort of instigated me. But overall, I decided that this is what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. But certain features that I liked were absent, or certain features that were present that I didn't like, or the combinations of those things that sort of instigated me. And just to give you a, you know, before wrapping up my answer on this question, giving you a little bit of a flavor for what those points are, you know, one is the concentration level within the portfolio. Two is global approach. Three is, you know, fee arrangement. And, you know, there are each one of those areas can take, you know, several conversations by itself. But those are some of the highlights that sort of drove me to set this up on my own.
Okay, let's dig into that portfolio strategy a little bit. You mentioned the concentration as one of the elements there. What is your philosophy around portfolio concentration? And do you have a limit on how many companies you can have in the portfolio?
And that's a good question. I've had some of my own investors raise that as well. And I've went to University of Chicago. Eugene Fama, who got a Nobel not too long ago for preaching to the world that there is no free lunch and that individual stock picking is not a profitable endeavor. Essentially, that's the gist of it. But the education part of it from that institution, from him, I didn't take his class, by the way. It was an extremely challenging class. I didn't take it. But essentially, you know, since he is the demigod on campus, every finance class has his influence on it. Joel Greenblatt, I'm sure you've heard of him. He used to teach at Columbia. I don't know if he still teaches. But he wrote this fantastic book called You Can Be a Stock Market Genius. He's the one that I have come closest to in terms of getting an answer to this question. Not that I know him, but in that book, You Can Be a Stock Market Genius, in the first few pages, he sort of addresses this. Now, the advantage of getting the market, the index, is, you know, you pretty much get everything that's available, that's publicly traded. And you can never eliminate the risks associated with the market. But you can get a majority of the benefit of the market by having certain number of securities. He starts with 5 stocks in a portfolio or 5 securities in a portfolio. You can get 83% benefit. As the number increases, the benefit from the market diversification increases, but then it plateaus out. By the time you hit 14, 15 stocks or securities, the benefits of being diversified kind of plateaus out. And not only that, as you kind of increase the number of securities, it actually becomes more detrimental. I mean, you now have more names to cover, more variables to be mindful of, academically speaking, the research also proves out that the benefit actually peters out after that. So that's more sort of an academic point to that question. But when you observe some of these, you know, superstar investors over time, Buffett and Munger being a couple of the big names in that bucket, but there are others who have successfully invested in the market. And you can even think of all these entrepreneurs. I mean, when Jeff Bezos was running Amazon until recently, you know, he had a double-digit percent, 17-some percent of the stock in his portfolio. So, you know, same case with Bill Gates and Microsoft. So you both have entrepreneurs and other investment managers who have given us, who have, you know, blazed the trail by running a fairly concentrated portfolio. Concentration is a sort of a generic term in that regard. You know, Munger over time has said anything, you know, he's absolutely comfortable holding 3 securities in his portfolio. I'm not quite there yet. Nick and Zach, when they ran their portfolio, they essentially brought it down from wherever it was, you know, 20-some names all the way to just about 3. So there are, you know, enough examples to tell us that concentration actually works with the right kind of analysis, with the right kind of mindset, and it also may involve the personalities that are actually involved in running that fund, running that particular portfolio. So combination of both, you know, practical observation from other people who have done it, academic studies that tell me that there is a limit to how much you want to have, and my own personal experience. There are certain areas that I've been exposed to that I'm fairly comfortable with, certain others that I'm not. And so you sort of eliminate those things that I'm not comfortable with. And it all brings me down to somewhere around 8 to 12 securities. There is no hard and fast rule. I've run the portfolio with 9 stocks for about 15 some months. And then currently I have 10. As I mentioned, I don't mind going down to 8. I don't mind going up to 12 for the right reasons. But beyond 12, it becomes, for me, it becomes a little challenging. Not just the 12 names that I own, I'm also tracking, following a whole bunch. And some of the peers to the 10 names that I have in the portfolio, all this will add up, and the number of securities that I might have to follow would sort of increase way beyond the time available. So that's why I sort of limit myself to about 10, and there is no hard and fast rule.
You also wrote at one point that you are comfortable being fully invested. That seems to be, I guess, sort of an uncommon trait in that a lot of managers, active managers that you follow, and tend to have some level of cash on the side ready to deploy. Why is that something you're comfortable with?
No, thank you. I can already tell that you've done some digging on some of the work that I've done. Yes, I did write about this some time back. There are several reasons for this. You know, the time horizon is one factor. How long is the time horizon for your investment style? I'll come back to that in a second. You know, that's an important factor. Number two is the question about, sitting on cash to deploy essentially means you're trying to time the market. You know, that may be fine in pockets like COVID or the 2008 financial crisis when you really have a completely disrupted market. But in general, 75% of the time, the market is going up. And so sitting on cash to deploy capital essentially means you're not only trying to time the market, but you have to be right twice, you know, to be able to sell something to sit on cash, or maybe you're getting new cash. If that's the case, you're waiting for the deployment, which means you then have to be right again in terms of, you know, deploying it into the market. I prefer to, this again goes back to the personality aspect that I talked about earlier. I prefer to think about investing in decadal terms. One of the writers that I follow is Ben Carlson, and he recently wrote about the time, the market performance over a long stretch of time. And in fact, one of his readers had asked him, why not you start from 1932 instead of going all the way back to 1926 and tell us what the performance would have been? And he chose 1932, and he said, if you invested $10,000 in 32, over 75 years, it becomes $36 million. There are a number of different lessons from that point. You know, the time period is an important ingredient in the eventual outcome. You can also sit back and appreciate the volatility that the market had endured. And all you had to do all through that 75-year period is just sit tight. You had extremely disruptive events happen: World War II, Korean War, 60s, inflation, oil embargo, one after the other. And yet you came out with, you know, a phenomenal return in the end. And so I think about my investing in terms of, in decadal terms, 10 plus years, as long as you sort of extend it more than, you know, a few quarters or even a few years, I think eventual outcome, depending upon the type of investment, eventual outcome can be phenomenal. And that's where this quality bias, my own personality style, they also come into play. So it's a mix of a number of different things: time horizon, the ability, the availability and the ability to invest in quality securities, and then bringing my own personality and bringing my own personal preference to bear, and then, you know, just waiting it out over a long stretch of time. That's what makes me comfortable sitting in cash. Since you referred to that article that I wrote, you know, there is a nice chart where JP Morgan shows you, you know, what happens if you missed, you know, if you missed just the top 10 days during a particular period, or top 20 days, the returns start going down precipitously. I'll let you read that later at a later point, but the point is, now you want to be in the market, you want to have patience, and you know, you want to allow the power of compounding to work for you.
I like that. And one other great write-up that you had on your website was, and I love this title, you said, borrowed conviction is worse than borrowed money. Can you share that story of how you, I guess, maybe learned that lesson the hard way?
Yeah. I think you're referring to one of the articles where I wrote about Newell Brands.
I think so.
You know, instead of talking about a specific stock, the idea there was, you know, it's easy to get carried away by certain types of personalities, certain types of investors, or certain types of investments. What we want to have is the ability to make decisions on our own. We all have the capacity to, you know, capacity to make the right decision, but we many times get carried away by the bigger personalities, the bigger, the, you know, interesting investment opportunities, and the decisions that these other personalities, bigger personalities, have made to invest in a specific security, unless you know them exceptionally well, and you're essentially blind on the other side. Just because this manager has invested, it doesn't mean that it gives you the required amount of confidence to invest in it. Sometimes you are able to look at that investment that this super investor has made, and you're able to dig in. But then constantly there is this feeling, I don't know if I agree with this, but the super investor has invested. Let me continue to push forward. And you get to a point where you're not able to then, because you've committed so much time and resources, you're not able to step out. There are various different issues that come out of this. So during, as a result of one of the mistakes that I had made with this type of approach, is why I ended up writing this article. Borrowed conviction is essentially somebody else being convinced that a particular investment is a great investment for that person. Gives you the confidence to either make that investment or at least start due diligence and start digging in. As a result of that type of an experience, I not only wrote that article, but I sort of these days, stand back and don't get carried away by the 13 Fs and 13 Gs and 13 Ds that these big investors file. I really don't know the motivation. I really don't know the analysis, and I really don't know their time period. And given my investing style, which is focused more on quality-oriented businesses, I find very, very, very rarely do I come across anything interesting through those types of documents.
So do you ever look at 13 Fs anymore, or have you basically gotten to the point where it's not worth your time?
I do. Some investors, some of my friends and actual investors in my own fund will point out a few things every once in a while. But there was a period. As I said, I've spent a lot of time at Advisory and at Keeley. There was a period when I used to, wait with a bated breath for these 13 Fs and Ds to come out. It was a different lifestyle, a different investing approach. The portfolios were different. And so it made sense, perhaps made sense then. But today, what I spend my time on is thinking about my existing portfolio, the opportunity set. I spend more like about 87% of the of my time on the existing portfolio. There is so much to learn about these companies, and that's where I spend my time. Sometimes these days I'll see 13F where somebody announces an investment in one of my portfolio companies. That happened not too long ago with Zyco and Berkshire Hathaway. And that obviously makes me smile a bit. I still don't know what the analysis was on the other side. I do think Heiko is the Berkshire Hathaway of aircraft parts, but that sort of a development I do cherish, but I don't necessarily chase 13 Fs or Ds or Gs.
When you were talking about your portfolio concentration, you mentioned that you have sort of that watch list, I guess, that you maintain coverage on, and you continue to track those companies as well, but they're not in the portfolio. What's the, I guess, what's holding you back from potentially including one of those in the portfolio? Is it typically evaluate? Are you waiting for like the right price, or is it you're waiting to know the business better? Is there sort of a common characteristic?
Great question, Ryan. And there again, I have continued to evolve. I have about a dozen to 15 names that I track on that watch list bucket. You know, the reason why I have them in watch list is a few different factors. One, I'm still learning more about the company, more about the industry. Very rarely, these days, it's very rarely due to valuation. You know, it's there because I like the business. This again goes back to my investment objective. You know, is it a business that I can understand? Is it run by quality management team? Is it a quality business? And then is it at a reasonable valuation? A few points here or there, that doesn't deter me. But it's mostly because I'm still trying to learn. It could be because I'm still waiting to talk to the management team. I try to meet with or talk to the management teams of every one of my companies. I haven't met with all of them, but that's the objective over time. Get to see them, get to meet them in, you know, different settings. So those types of calls maybe are pending, or maybe certain other, you know, industry developments or macro level developments have sort of held me back. It could be a number of different of those factors, but they may never get into the portfolio. For all I know, they may never get into the portfolio. They may actually get replaced by something new. But if there is an alignment on all those factors, eventually moves in. So there is no one factor that is holding me back. It's a combination of things.
Makes sense. I want to dig in a little bit to your investment criteria that you've got laid out on your website. And maybe I can just kind of go one by one because I've got some follow-ups for these. The first one, or the first layer, I guess, of your investment criteria is the business within my circle of competence? You've been investing for a long time. You've been in the, you've been an investment professional for some time.
Right.
What would you classify as your circle of competence? And then would you say that you're still trying to widen it?
Yeah, absolutely. So, as I mentioned, I was an investment banker. Before B school, I was an accountant in an insurance company, a global insurance company. And prior to that, I worked for a small real estate firm. So post B school, I did a lot of work in the FIG group, Financial Institutions Group. I did M&A in that space. And then I ended up working for a bank, doing M&A for the bank. So, you know, financial institutions or fintech is a space that sort of jumps out from that part of their resume. I've spent a lot of time digging into certain other sectors, industrials, tech, consumers, consumer durable, consumer staples. But I've never spent time looking into oil and gas, energy, or Bitcoin. I've never trained as a medical professional, so biotech and that space is kind of outside my sphere of, you know, influence. So I'd say a few sectors like mining and Bitcoin and biotech and all those things fall outside my area of expertise. Fortunately, there are many others that fall within. So I tend to make my mistakes within the sectors that I know.
The second pillar of your investment criteria, sort of a seemingly simple question, but kind of, I think, a deceivingly complex answer. The question is this a good business? How do you define a good business? And then what are some of the qualitative characteristics that you like to look for?
Right. In fact, between that question and the management is where I spend most of my time when I'm digging into a company. So there are many factors that come into play when I ask this very simple, seemingly simple question: is it a quality business? First of all, when I deploy capital into a name, I'm generally looking to double my capital over a business cycle. Right? A business cycle is somewhere around 5 to 7 years. And if it is within 5 years, it essentially translates into approximately 15% return per year. And if that's the return that I need from the individual companies, I'm looking, that's at the portfolio level, right? From the individual companies, I'm looking for something better than that. And so what do I mean by returns? Is it ROE or OIC or OCE? No, it's essentially cash generated over a stretch of time over the capital invested. So, you know, without necessarily putting formulas and stuff in a video audio call, I'd say it's the cash return over capital deployed, and not just the cash over capital, but it's the incremental return. Incremental return over a stretch of time. Since I said I invest in decadal units, I generally look for at least a 10-year performance over which that incremental return has been healthy. Healthy meaning something, you know, better than 15%. And it's not just the return. There is another important factor that comes into play, and that's the reinvestment. I'm sure you've heard of, you've heard Buffett mentioned his investment with Seascandy and his challenge with reinvestment because there isn't much. It just, you know, gives them the capital to deploy it elsewhere. But the individual companies, I'm looking for this healthy return and an opportunity to reinvest, preferably reinvest the whole thing back. I mean, math plays out that way, right? If the company can continue to reinvest 100% of its cash back into the business. First of all, there are very few of them that can take in that kind of capital back over a long stretch of time. But if they can, the management should do this. You know, with some of the prospects, some of the people that I talk to, I run this math around this question. The math is, if we take a penny, say last night around or yesterday around this time, say there was a penny and you kept doubling it every day. You know, it becomes two today, it becomes four, eight. And by the 30th day, it essentially, that penny becomes somewhere around, 5.6 million dollars. It's a massive number. And more importantly, what is it on the 29th day? It's half of that, right? So a few factors come into play in that math, which is, yeah, the eventual outcome is a massive number. But what that tells us is compounding takes time. It's at least a 30-year period in that exercise. And that it's also back-end heavy. The 29th day is half of what you get on the 30th day. So that happens only because I've been reinvesting 100% of the cash back. I took the penny, I doubled it, reinvested it, and then reinvested it without any transaction. There is no friction, right? Without any transaction costs or taxes, I'm just doing the same thing again and again. It's okay on a piece of paper, it doesn't work in practice. But to show the power of compounding and why I look for this kind of reinvestment, I think it's a good exercise. And I do have a couple of companies in the portfolio that have that. We'll come back to that later. But the combination of high reinvestment and the high incremental return, that's what allows a business to kind of, you know, increase its intrinsic value over time. And understanding this math, you know, running the math is fine, But understanding if it is sustainable, why has it happened over time? What has the management done to end up with this equation at this point in time when I'm looking at this company? Understanding these factors, all those questions, they become important, and that's where I end up spending most of my time.
So you mentioned management there, and that is sort of your third pillar here, and I guess one of the two that you end up spending the most time on. Management, it seems like one of the hardest things to define, like what makes a good management, because it's not always the same. What are some examples that you've come across of great management teams? And are there any, I guess, traits or characteristics that you like to see from a manager?
Yeah, I'm continuing to evolve, learn, make mistakes on that front as well. If you take a step back, particularly when you're investing in these publicly traded securities, you're an outsider looking in. Of course, there is plenty of publicly available documents, but the decision points are somewhat still opaque, right? The management sitting inside is making certain decisions. Sometimes they're able to be very explicit, come out and say that publicly, but most times they don't. So you have to sort of read between the lines, understand why and what the repercussions have been or will be, things like that. So, we can dive into specific companies and try and understand why has this management team reinvested as opposed to going out and acquiring, or why has the team developed a culture? And that's an important, very important feature that I look for these days. The culture within the company is something that sort of doesn't happen by accident. And it doesn't necessarily show up on a financial statement either, right? So understanding that piece, that part of the business, the culture within the organization, I spend more of my time, parsing through the qualitative features. So, for example, I own this company called Hermès in France. It's a luxury company, been around for 188 years old now. Sixth generation family member running it. They just held their call last week. Phenomenal company in terms of culture, the way they have developed their artisans within the company, the way they have deployed capital back into opening up new leather shops, hiring people. We've got 25,000 people now around the world. The culture within the company is very unique. You can see that. People, more than 60-some% of the employee base is still within France. These are all small villages, several generations of family members working for the same company. In this most recent call, for example, Axel Dumas, the CEO, said, you're making a special bonus payment to all the employees of 4,500 euros. They take care of the certain specific leather artisans separately, but, this is just the bonus. On top of it, they actually also announced a special dividend this time. But not just financial remuneration, but the way the people are treated. I'm sure there is a little bit of fat within the company because of that kind of a treatment. But the culture within the company is they are willing and able and very receptive. They operate more like a family. And you can sort of set that against many other luxury companies and compare and contrast. Nothing wrong with those styles either. In fact, Bernard Arnault, the CEO of LVMH, who went after Hermès in the 2000s, in some of the earnings calls, he talked about how the culture is very different between the two companies. And he did say, there's nothing wrong with either one. It's just different. So as an investor, I prefer certain things that in a long-term long-term portfolio, I want to see. And so I've chosen Hermes over everything else. There are other financial considerations that have gone in as well. But that understanding that culture part is a time-consuming exercise. It needs a lot of work, reflecting, introspecting, understanding what the company is saying, reading between the lines. So that's where that's the reason why I end up spending so much time on that question number two.
Okay, and the last sort of pillar in your process is the valuation work. Is the company trading at a reasonable valuation? What's your process for that? How do you go about valuing the business?
Yeah, this again is a sort of an analysis of history a little bit of looking into the future. But the reason why I say it that way is to be able to look into the future, you need to be able to see the history. One of the features of a quality business is not just high returns, but the predictability, the consistency with which the cash flows have been generated. That predictability and consistency is something that you can see only by looking at the history. So in some of the companies that have been around for a long enough time, I run more than 20 years of financials to see that consistency. And that allows me to look for how to think about the future. And in coming up, you know, obviously the stock price is supposed to be the present value of all the future cash flows. And that's to time infinity. You cannot, I generally don't think about time infinity that way, but you know, at least to give some sense of what the performance is likely to be over the foreseeable future. So somewhere around 3 to 5 years is what I pencil in. And, arriving at a reasonable valuation, it's different for different types of companies. A company like Hermes, which has been, you know, they generate a gross margin of 70-some%, one of the highest. It's more like a software company. Net operating margin is more in the 40-some% range. No debt on the balance sheet, consistently growing at, 15-some%. I view this to be a quality business that can sustain, that can continue to operate at that level. And so I'm willing to pay a multiple that is better than what the market is generally commanding. And so it all translates into a cash flow metric. I look for a decent free cash flow yield. At this point, I've owned it for more than 3 years now. Yeah, if you looked at the portfolio today, just forecast it for 1 year, it may look like a free cash flow yield of, 2%, which is expensive relative to 10-year treasury. However, if you can think about the sustainability of the free cash over a long stretch of time, the current 2% may actually look cheap relative to what it may be 5-10 years down the road. So it's both a quantitative and a qualitative mix in answering that valuation question.
Hey listeners, before we move on, I want to mention the company that actually runs the show. AUM is a FinChat podcast. FinChat.io is the fastest growing equity research platform on the internet. Powered by AI, FinChat offers institutional grade financial data on all stocks globally. And the best part is the data extends well beyond the generic financial metrics. You know all those company specific metrics that you track on your own spreadsheets? I'm talking about Amazon segment revenue, Netflix's paying subscribers by region, Chipotle's comp sales, Uber's active customers, Spotify MAUs. FinChat tracks all of it so you don't have to. If those numbers matter to you, I recommend checking out the platform. All new users get 2 weeks free of FinChat Pro automatically. So head on over to finchat.io and check it out. Now let's get back to the interview. Okay, I want to jump to some company-specific questions. The first company I want to talk about is Dino Polska, which might be a company that some of our listeners have never heard of. So I guess, when did you discover Dino Polska? Can you maybe give some of the, a synopsis on what the business does? And then what are some of the characteristics you liked about it?
Right. So I run 23 different screens every week. They get delivered to my inbox. I use CapIQ and I run a variety of different screens, and cash return on capital is one of them. And that's the one thing that I find very appealing, CapIQ. I'll talk to Braden about some of these things separately, but that's how I sort of stumbled onto Dino Polska. This was just about 4.5 years ago. So what is Dino Polska? This is a grocery chain that's based in Poland, traded in the Warsaw Stock Exchange, run by the founder of the company, Tomasz Biernacki, who was in his early 50s. The company was founded in the western part of the country. Started with, no stores. The family background is in meatpacking and cattle rearing and things like that. So he started this operation in late 1999, 2000 timeframe. It was a private company, sold it to a private equity firm, bought it back, and then eventually took them public in 2015 or 16 timeframe. So today there are about 2,500 stores, give or take. And the unique features about this business, it's a traditional grocery chain. It's about 500 square meters. It's a Polish or European company. They talk about square meters instead of square feet. 5,000 SKUs. They sell the traditional, grocery chain stuff, vegetables, beverages, fruits, things like that. And one unique aspect of this, because of the family connection, is they also sell fresh meat, raw meat. The competitors, there are many of them, actually. One locally grown competitor, Biedronka, is the name of the company, owned by a Portuguese company now, has the biggest market share in the country. And then a few German operators are there, Aldi and Lidl, and a few other local and other competitors are also operating there. But the unique feature of Dino is from the get-go, they were focusing more on the rural parts of Poland. Poland has about 38 million people, approximately the size of California. Unique to Poland is the urbanization, the low urbanization rate. There are more people living in rural Poland than in bigger cities. Essentially, that's what it translates into in English. Dino Polska has always focused on these, smaller to small towns and villages. And, in 2010, for example, they had 110 stores. And as I mentioned, at the end of the year, 2024, there are a little more than 2,500 stores. A good clip, about 27-28% compounded. And other unique feature is not right from the get-go, but sometime around the mid-2000s on, the founder, Tomasz Biernacki, decided to own the land on which these stores sit. So he buys the land from, farmers, agricultural land. He has his own vertically integrated real estate or logistics unit that goes and creates the same exact rectangular box, that can accommodate these 5,000 SKUs and stuff. with a small parking lot and puts them in these areas that are within walking distance in smaller towns and villages. Thinks about each store being able to service about 3,000 to 5,000 people and being exceptionally successful doing it. So he has these stores, distribution centers, meat processing plant within Poland. And I think it can easily double the number of stores from here.
Yeah, it sounds like sort of that two-pronged approach you have to business quality, where they're not only generating the returns on the capital that they deploy, but the reinvestment runway seems to be quite large. I guess
yes.
That investment looks like it's been very successful. What have you drawn any lessons away from the success of Dino Polska that maybe you can apply to other grocers or other retailers or I guess other companies elsewhere?
A few both positive and sort of challenges as well. You know, the fact that Dino owns almost all the land on, you know, under these stores. Not all of them. Early on, they did lease a few. That translates into a significant advantage, particularly, you know, as you know, since the war started just about 3.5 years ago, inflation shot up in Europe, Central Europe, particularly Poland. And during those types of periods, owning the land actually helps from an operational standpoint. You know, you don't have to go re-lease the land. And that's a significant advantage. I own a company here called Copart, which also owns the land of these salvage yards. It's a significant advantage relative to the competition, but also a significant advantage in terms of operating leverage and operating performance in general. Well, that is, well, you know, that's a significant lesson from Dino Polska. On the flip side, you know, it's after all a grocery chain. It's a retail investment. Retail, while fairly easy to understand on paper, is one of the most treacherous areas to invest in. Lots of big investors have stumbled. Yeah, knock on wood. So far, this has worked out. But one of the important points that I'm keeping an eye on as it relates to Dino Polska is, see, any investment, any quality investment that I look at needs to have a decent pricing power. Pricing power is, again, something that is not visible on the financials as is, but it becomes a little more evident, particularly during down times. You can tell if the volume is going down or if the total revenue stream is being impacted as a result. Either, you know, they're able to keep up the price even though the volume is going down and things like that. So this is a company that sort of relies a little bit on pricing its products on some of these bigger discounters, including this big competitor that I talked about, Biedronka. So indirectly they rely on somebody else. So they don't necessarily have the type of pricing power that I'm looking for, but it became evident during these, you know, post-war periods. So both good lessons. You know, there's value to be had from owning the land and retail being a treacherous place also teaches you about the pricing power.
Sure. Another company that I'd like to ask about is Kinsale. A company I believe you've spoken about a couple of times. I guess another company that most people haven't heard of. Can you give a brief overview? And I guess, where does it fit within the insurance industry?
Yeah. So, you know, this is very unique to the American insurance landscape. Insurance as a business is probably the second or the third oldest in the country. You know, the a traditional, before jumping into the description itself, the American landscape in insurance is kind of driven by the insurance regulators in each state. There are 50 regulators around the country. And so they all have their own requirements as far as the insurance company domiciled within their states. So that then leads to the larger definition of insurance space. When we think about property casualty insurance, that are both public and private, the publicly traded insurance companies are, somewhere around 60, including some of the really illiquid ones. But there are thousands of insurance companies, most of them are private. And because of this structure that I described, each regulator within the state requires certain approvals, certain documents. Insurance companies, think of State Farm or Allstate or Geico for that matter, they all need to, file documents with the regulators to get any sort of price increase, premium increase. So, given the wildfires in California or the hurricanes in Florida, these insurance companies still need to go to those state regulators and ask for a premium increase on, say, auto insurance or home insurance or whatever the line may be. And sometimes they get it. Sometimes the regulator says, no, the increase that you're asking for is too much. We can't. There are many other discussions back and forth, and they don't get it. And as a result, you've seen, for example, Allstate pull out of Florida, auto insurance in Florida. And I'm sure over time, some of those traditional insurers are going to pull out of California for wildfires as well. So that's the larger insurance landscape. And just because an Allstate is pulling out of Florida doesn't mean the need for insurance has gone away, right? So where do they go? Where do the auto owners go? That's where this excess and surplus subcategory within insurance comes into play. That's a space that's about $115 billion in total size as we speak. A number of operators offer both the standard insurance, regulated by the state regulators, and excess and surplus insurance, where they have absolutely they don't have any form or filing requirement to get any price increase. They have complete control over how much they charge. Today we have Berkshire Hathaway is the largest excess and surplus operator. Post their acquisition of Allegheny, they became the number one operator in that space. AIG is the second largest, and so on and so forth. Kinsale is a player in that space, which does only excess and surplus. It's the only publicly traded operator that offers exclusively E&S. And they have about 1.5-2% market share of the larger space. There are also other differences relative to the standard underwriters and other underwriters who offer both standard E&S. So Kinsale, because of its size, doesn't necessarily compete with Berkshire or AIG on a regular basis. But there are other providers. I'm sure you've heard of Markel, which is also based in Richmond, Virginia, W.R. Berkley, and other subsidiaries, for example, of say Fairfax in Canada. There are subsidiaries here in the U.S. that Kinsale sort of competes with. The interesting aspect of Kinsale is they have only one office. Everything is done within Richmond. all its close to 600 some employees are all based in that one office. Everybody comes in there, and even during COVID, everybody had to come into the office and, you know, work from there. Richmond is not New York or San Francisco, and so it's not quite as expensive as those two coastal towns, coastal cities may be. And then they have their own IT infrastructure over time. This is a company that was founded in 2010, and they have developed their own IT infrastructure, which allows them to turn around and quote on submissions. I'm using a few terms that are unique to insurance. Let me pause to define a little bit of those. So think of a Florida hospice care or some kind of a senior citizen housing unit that needs insurance. And for a variety of reasons, they're not able to go to, say, standard underwriter, whoever that may be. And what do? They do need some kind of a coverage. And what do? They call up the broker, you know, think of, I don't know, Brown and Brown or some local broker that they use, insurance broker. And that insurance broker will say, okay, I've searched. I'm not able to find the standard underwriter. I need to go to some excess and surplus underwriter. And so he calls up one of the wholesale brokers. You know, there is one publicly traded wholesale broker here in Chicago. There's about, you know, there's a number of them, but it's kind of consolidated in the top 10, 12 names. So he'll call up the wholesale broker, and the wholesale broker is the one who calls up Kinsale and says, okay, there is this property in Florida. And that inbound request from that wholesale broker, that's the submission. And Kinsale responds back with a quote. Now, many insurance companies, that process takes a week, 10 days, things like that. Inbound submission, and another insurance company will have to find an underwriter, respond back. That's generally the time span. Well, Kinsale, they turn around like that. That's one of the unique features of Kinsale. They turn around typically within less than 24 hours. And so they're able to quote on submissions at a rate that is unheard of in the space. And they bind is the final policy being written on that property, on that insured. They bind a small percentage of the original submission, a very small percentage. So they're very careful. Once they quote, you know, there is back and forth, and eventually they get to a binding process. So all that makes them very unique, which is sort of different from the larger insurance space, both standard and even the E&S, that has allowed them to underwrite. Now, insurance is a space that has two very important metrics that people need to keep an eye on. One is the loss ratio, you know, how much losses are coming in after you've written the premium or after you've underwritten. And two is the expense ratio, how much does it cost to write that. The combination of those two is called combined ratio. So as long as you can incur a combined ratio of less than $1 on a $1 premium, you are underwriting at a profit. The biggest auto insurance company today is Progressive. They underwrite at 96% combined, meaning they look for a profit of 4 cents on every dollar. The average combined ratio of Kinsale is in the low 70%. So they look for a profit of about 25 to 28 cents on every dollar of premium. So it's an exceptionally profitable operation, meaning they keep a very close eye on underwriting and they keep a very close eye on the expenses. So that's why they've been able to grow at a phenomenal pace. I believe They have a long runway to continue to grow, perhaps not at the 40-some percent that they've been growing recently, but more in the 10 to 20% range that the management team is more comfortable with. And more importantly, I think they'll be able to underwrite at the historical 75-some percent range.
Okay, that's a very comprehensive overview, so appreciate
perhaps
it.
Perhaps that's not what you're looking for, but yeah.
No, it was kind of a insurance 101 as well, so I appreciate that. We've got two wrap-up questions for you here. First one is going to be, who are some other investors that you admire?
Oh, yeah. There are many of them that I admire. As I mentioned early on, I've looked at the traditional, the big names, the super investors. I continue to keep an eye on some of them, Terry Smith out of UK. But, what I'm looking for is not necessarily, stocks or names that they own. What I'm looking for is their, is how they are thinking, about the market, about the specific investment. What has allowed them to get to where they are. And so in that category, I kind of keep an eye on a number of different people. And I already mentioned Dave Contessaria at Valley Forge. He writes well. Jeff Gannon is an individual who runs Focused Compounding, a phenomenal thinker and a good writer, specifically as it relates to stocks. He doesn't write much outside of stocks, but yeah, he's one. There's a gentleman by the name of Peter Hollis in Scotland. He came out of Baillie Gifford, writes well, thinks about individual businesses in a way that is very unique to him. Actually, the gentleman that sort of asked me to take a look at Kinsale, his name is Rajiv Lapazia. He runs a fund out of New Jersey, a good thinker, and a few individuals who run both portfolios and blog posts. There's a gentleman by the name of Leandro in Spain. He runs a blog post called Best Anchor Stocks. Another gentleman by the name of Galician Investor in Spain. These are all, what I'm looking for is how these people are thinking and, evaluating the market. So those are the people, but eventually you want to have certain personalities that can guide you even when they're not in the same room, right? In that category, I sort of have two individuals that I look for. One is a gentleman by the name of Bharat Shah. He's out of India. He's now the chief investment officer for a big fund out of India. I've met him a few times. And then he actually wrote this. Allow me to say this in one of his books. He said, investing outcome is not only a function of one's intellectual curiosity, but also a function of one's ability to control the emotions and temperament. It's vital to know what is right, and it's also important to know how to practice what is right. Many a times one needs to save oneself from one's own self, and having a right friend who can guide one to stay within the right boundaries is critical. And for me, that friend is Chris Mayer, the gentleman who wrote the book, Hunter Baggers. I try to be that for him, and he's absolutely the guy that I go to, with advice, requesting guidance. So sort of people all over the place, but Chris is the one I spend the most time with, but I talk to many others that I listed there.
All right. And last question for you. What is one piece of advice you would give to someone entering the investment industry today?
Yeah. So a person entering the investment industry probably has a lot of different sources to figure out how to evaluate a stock, how to evaluate a business, how to talk to the management team, things like that. But the most important thing that people don't necessarily know coming in is the need for knowing himself or herself. Now, there's a fabulous book by Adam Smith, not the original one, but the pseudonym Adam Smith, called The Money Game. He has some very profound statements in the book, but he says, what is it that good managers have? And he answers it himself. Now, it's kind of a locked-in concentration, intuition, a feel, nothing that can be schooled. The first thing you need to know is yourself. So that's what I would say. Find out who you are, and that requires introspection. Perhaps that requires some experience. But then if you don't know who you are, the market is an expensive place to find out.
That's great advice. That is going to do it for today. Thank you, Srikanth, for joining the show. Thank you, everyone, for tuning in to this episode of AUM. I'd like to remind listeners that the AUM podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. All opinions expressed on the show by hosts or guests are solely their own and do not constitute formal advice or a recommendation. Thank you again to Sri for joining the show, and we'll see you all next time.
Thanks, Ryan.